And, of course, this hour we'll take your phone calls with Dr. Melvin Willen as we talk about the paranormal world, so jump aboard. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, our final hour with Dr. Melvin Willen and your phone calls. Melvin, when a real, true skeptic, more skeptical, let's say, than you, comes to talk to you about the paranormal, what do you say to a skeptic?
I say to them, can we really talk to each other? Because if their mind is so closed, they're so blinkered, then is there any point in me banging my head against their brick wall? Having said that, if I can find a little chink in their I don't believe anything armor, then perhaps we can have a decent discussion.
That's a good point. And do you find that they're argumentative?
Yes, quite often they are, because
yeah,
they are convinced about what they're saying and what they're perceiving. And on the other hand, I like to have some escape routes in case I've got it wrong.
Now, do you deal with ufology at all?
Not really. That's beyond my remit. I've got a healthy respect for it, of course, because, I mean, the sky is full of unidentified flying objects.
Oh, yeah.
We can't identify them, can we? That's why they're unidentified. It doesn't make them from Mars or Neptune or something. But when people talk about being abducted, then I find that quite interesting, because they used to be abducted by sort of demons and what have you, and now it seems that they're abducted by aliens from spacecraft.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of the paranormal music that you've worked on and investigated, generally, what does it sound like?
Well, it sounds very similar. If it's a composer that's coming through, then it sounds very similar to their work, and it has to be then analyzed to see how close it is. And also, you have to look to the medium, because if the medium is already a trained musician, then it's possibly they've just tapped into their subconscious and they're producing something that they could produce. But when they are not, I mean, the famous one, Rosemary Brown, a housewife from Wimbledon, famous for its tennis, of course, in England, she was a dinner lady, so she sorted out dinners for pupils in schools. So she wasn't musically trained, and then lo and behold, she starts writing music down that's way, way beyond her normal capability.
Now, with this kind of music, are they trying to send us a message? Is there a reason for it?
Yeah, I think it varies. With some of the composers, it's a message to say there is life after death in the spirit realms, etc., etc.
Yeah.
But with most of them, it's the feel, it's the need to just keep on composing. If that's what you did in your earthly existence, perhaps if you go to some other realm, you want to keep doing what you did and enjoyed doing before.
Now, in your work, Melvin, do you interview people who have gone through some of these experiences?
Yes, lots and lots of them.
Pretty convincing.
Some of them are very convincing. There was one chap that I interviewed, he sadly died a couple of years ago, who believed that the spirit of Caruso, the singer, was coming through him.
Aha. Uh-huh.
And I thought, right, well, this will be interesting. So I went off to his house, which was near Cambridge in England, and he was a Cockney from the East End of London. So you couldn't find a less likely character. It was a sort of a lot of gorblimey and do you want a cup of tea, mate, and all this sort of stuff. And he said, I suppose you want me to sing. And I thought, this is going to be dire. and he got his son to play the piano, and he played something from Tosca. And he started to sing, and I almost fell off my chair. It was absolutely fantastic.
You couldn't believe it was coming out of his mouth, right?
I was a few feet away from him, so I had to believe it. And I recorded it, of course. And it's remarkable. And to this day, that and many other pieces that he sang and recorded, I don't know quite how he did it, unless he had some sort of talent lurking in him, which we don't understand. So let's investigate.
If somebody thinks that something is bizarre happening, a poltergeist experience or something else, what do you suggest they do? Where do they go for help?
Okay, well, initially, they should keep a diary of everything that's going on, because the memory plays terrible tricks. And if you write everything down and record as much as you can, if you can record things going on, video, everybody's got phones these days they can record things with, that's ideal. The Society for Psychical Research in England is the leading organization. In America, I'm not sure whether it's still going, but you did have the American Society for Psychical Research. That would also be another valid organization. And then talk to as many people as possible, get people to sort of see if they can witness what you're witnessing as well.
All right, let's take some calls here for you as they begin to line up. Joe in the Bronx to get us started. Hi, Joe.
Hi, George. How are you?
All righty, Joey. Thanks.
Good. Yeah, Melvin, I had a question. Has there ever been an example of a ghost, let's say of a rock group, that has occupied the stage while, you know, someone who's passed on, like a Jim Morrison, that has occupied the stage while the remaining members of the Doors have been in concert?
Now, to my knowledge, there hasn't been. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been. It just means that I can't think of an example. I can, however, think of, outside of the pop world, of composers, classical music composers, that have been perceived in situations where some of their music has been played and they've been sort of, you know, nodding approval of a performance or something.
Does paranormal music, Melvin, seem to be more prevalent than other kinds of hauntings or anything else like that?
No, I think the visual world that we live in has far more visual phenomena than musical phenomena. I mean, there's a fair amount of auditory phenomena. In other words, footsteps, voices, creaking doors, that sort of thing. But I don't call that musical phenomena because my definition of music is slightly different to what just pure sound is.
We've got Tracy truck driving in the state of Texas. Hi, Trace. Go ahead.
Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you, sir.
Melvin, I have a question as far as the Edenfield poltergeist. The Conjuring 2 was made about that, and you had never mentioned it. Were Ed and Lorraine Warren actually a part of that, or was it just for the movie?
Yep, okay. Yes, I didn't mention The Conjuring. The Conjuring bears very, very little resemblance to the actual case. The Warrens turned up at the very beginning of the case and were there very briefly. I've got the tape recording of their time there, which was probably about 20 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And they turned up out of the blue at the very, when the case was virtually over, caused a lot of disruption, I'm afraid, while they were there wanting to take the girls out for a meal, but not the boys, this sort of thing. And we're not in great favor with the Hodgson family at all. And then, lo and behold, The Conjuring came out, which, as I say, has very little to do with the Enfield case other than it's meant to be based on it.
Hollywood does things like that, Melvin, doesn't it?
You bet.
Yeah, Ed and Lorraine Warren, they're gone now, but they were great researchers, and Amityville Horror was probably their most widely recognized case, don't you think?
Yes, except, of course, the Amityville Horror was also proven by some people to actually be completely false, other than the original fact that somebody did murder their family while they were there. But a lot of the phenomena, blood coming out of the walls, etc., was never proven in any way, shape, or form.
Next up, Mike in Colorado. Hey, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Mike.
Call. And what an outstanding show tonight. I mean, the first half with the debate, and, you know, it means so much to me as a younger person that, you know, you do that kind of thing because it's really important in my future. So thank you, George.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Willen, first of all, I wanted to thank you so much for your work. I had a comment and a question tonight. So Shafika Krigler's book, I actually read that book, and I have a comment that kind of leads into my question surrounding that. So her book, Breakthrough to Creativity, it was really interesting in the sense that she was a very academic person, but the book wasn't necessarily written in an academic way. It was really written in a very honest and upfront way. But, I mean, there's definitely a lot of truth in that book in the sense of achieving that creativity through the senses you already have. And when we talk about ESP, a lot of what that is tapping into your own senses of perception to kind of reach that level. So my question is, so how much of ESP do you feel is actually tapping into your own levels of perception? Thank you.
Okay. Well, during the break, I had a quick look at the Kregula book because George having mentioned it to me, and I thought, well, this is pretty fascinating stuff, actually. I hadn't come across it before. So I had a quick look. And there's a section on ESP in the book, I noticed, in the context.
Yes, yes, absolutely.
I think that ESP is really, really, really important as far as the world of the so-called paranormal is. And I think a lot of it if not all of it, but certainly a lot of it, is inside of our own minds. And I think that if we can tap into it, I would say via music, of course, that's my big thing, but if we can tap into it in other ways, then we can open up ourselves to more things for the benefit, hopefully, of mankind than we would just going about with our normal senses.
Melvin, do you think ESP is a very normal, natural part of our own physical existence?
I think it might be, but it's extremely rare and difficult to work out how it operates and what the mechanism is for it to be used. I think once we've done that, then we will accept it far more than we do at the moment. At the moment, it's fringe, isn't it? I mean, you know, you talk about ESP, then you're perceived to be slightly off the wall.
Let's go to Tim in Richmond, Virginia. Welcome to the program, Tim.
How are you doing tonight?
Good.
I love the show. My wife and I were up in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, at the battlefield about 3 years ago. We're at the wheat field. It's right at about 9 o'clock at night. You can go out on the battlefield at night, just have to be off the tent. There were several other couples that we'd never met before, and to our right, you heard drum and fife in the distance, and it got progressively louder, and then louder, and louder, and then going off and going away from you. We saw nothing. There was no one playing music. There were no reenactors. The temperature dropped very suddenly once it got close, and then it warmed back up, and it was just a hair-raising experience. I just wanted to share that.
Well, then that's where this music comes in again, Melvin.
Yes. I'm so glad that you phoned in with that particular tale. We have many of those in England over various battlefields from the wars that we've had here. And they take on the same sort of format that you've just described for your experience as well. And I'm always totally intrigued when I hear new ones there. And, of course, I hadn't heard yours before. So, you know, thank you very much for sharing that, and I hope it wasn't too scary for you.
There are some regions of this planet, Melvin, like Gettysburg, that seem to be very, very, I don't want to use the word haunted, but apparitions seem to be all there because of the tragedy that occurred there.
Yes, there are. And it makes you wonder why there aren't some even more in other places, because I mean, you mentioned Gettysburg, and we had a dreadful civil war in this country in the 17th century with thousands of people dying, hence some of the music, actually, the reenactments of drums and fifes. The Scottish have Culloden and so on and so forth. But if you think of the slaughters that have taken place in other regions, some in Africa, Hiroshima in Japan, I mean, all over the world, why aren't there loads of recordings and reports, if you like, of phenomena taking place there as well?
We've got Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joseph, go ahead.
Hey, Melvin, I want to ask you about witchcraft and numbers. On the witchcraft, wonder what you thought of the Wizard of Oz and any part of the movie. But,
where'd that one come from, Joseph?
Yeah, well, she picked on the Wicked Witch picked on the Scarecrow, the Tin Man. She tried the Rust. She went for their weak points. So, and then, you know, it seems like, is witchcraft something someone could dabble with and get away from, or are they playing with fire? And then the number 666, I find it interesting that that's on a scale of 0 to 1,000, where a lot of times numbers are more so depicted between 0 and 10. And it goes on that 0 to 1,000 scale. I wonder if that's significant as well.
Okay. Well, two sort of points there. First of all, the witchcraft one. I personally don't think it's dangerous to dabble in it. It depends on the strength of your mind. If you're going to get spooked by it, whether it's the Ouija board or whether it's witchcraft or whether it's ghosts or anything else, horror films, you name it, then don't do it if you think that you're going to find it disturbing in any way. I've looked into witchcraft. I did not find it disturbing. I found it pleasant, open, natural-based, to do with nature. The people were very reasonable. They weren't trying to take me over or anything. But if you're worried about that, I wouldn't dabble with it. Keep away from it. As far as the 666 is concerned, yes, that's a sort of biblical reference, if I remember, from Revelation, something like that. Also, Aleister Crowley, the great beast, had it tattooed, I think, on himself, or he referred to himself as the great beast 666. Whether there's a mathematical significance to it, as you're sort of mentioning, I wouldn't like to say. You know, that's down to one's interpretation of the maths, I think.
In some of your research, Melvin, have you ever come across Satanists, and what do you think of them?
No, as far as I know, I've never met a Satanist. To be a Satanist, I presume you have to believe in Satan. Otherwise, why are you calling yourself a Satanist? And Satan is part of the Christian tradition, you know, the opposite of God, etc., etc. And that's got nothing to do with anything that I've come across.
What about vampires? Anything there?
Well, vampires, believe it or not, I do belong to the Dracula Society, which is a...
Do you really?
Yes, I do. It's a very literary group. We don't go around sucking people's blood, in case you're wondering.
What do they do?
Well, we have meetings. We talk about the literature, because there's not just Bram Stoker's Dracula. There's Nosferatu. There's various manifestations.
You don't have fanged teeth, though, do you?
Sorry?
They don't have fanged teeth, do they?
No. We all go to the dentist and have our checkups normally.
That's an interesting society. Tom's got a text or tweet for you. What do you have, Tom?
Hey, this one from John in South Dakota. Does your guest believe that musicians like Jimmy Page and Robert Johnson were really able to sell their souls for their talent?
Well, some people believe they did that. Melvin, what do you think?
Yep. No, I don't think they sold their souls to the devil or to anybody else for their talent. I think their talent came from their inert musicality, as well as a lot of work that went into it as well, because like most musicians will tell you, you don't just sit there and wait for Apollo to fire his musical arrow at you. You actually have to do quite a bit of practice in the interim as well.
Was it Christopher Marlowe who wrote Dr. Faustus?
Yes, well, that was one of the versions of it, yes.
Sold his soul to the devil, then didn't want to pay when the time came to pay up.
Sounds like using your credit card too much to me.
That's a good point, to be sure. So tell me about your next work. When can we expect it?
Well, of course, it was meant to come out at the beginning of next year sometime, and it almost certainly won't because of COVID, etc.
Yeah, push back everything.
It's an encyclopedia of music and the paranormal, and it's taking it on in a very broad sort of way. So therefore, there will be lots of entries from musical mediums that have made contact with dead composers, like I was talking about earlier. There'll be lots of references to places where haunting music has been heard, like the gentleman's story that he told us a bit earlier this evening. There'll be a variety of other things. There'll be like the occultists' interpretations of what music was. So, I mean, Pythagoras wrote at great length about music. There'll be things in there about it. There'll be sections about telepathy and extrasensory perception and music. There'll be about savants, musical savants, people that seem to have these phenomenal capabilities of playing. So by paranormal, it will also embrace abnormal and anomalous as well.
Sounds like we're going to get you back on when it's published. And do you have the U.S. publisher yet?
No, I'm still writing it. The publisher is Macfarlane, which is based in America.
Super. All right, well, stay with us, Melvin. We're going to come back and take final calls in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Dr. Melvin Willen. We're going to come back and take final phone calls in just a moment. Ian Punnett manning the desk tomorrow, so make sure you're listening to him. He'll have a special tribute to the life of Eddie Van Halen, and looking forward to that. And welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you, Dr. Melvin Willen with us. We've been talking about all kinds of things paranormal. In the Enfield poltergeist case, the little girls were 11 and 13. They would be 54 and 57 today, Melvin. Has anybody talked to them since this episode, now that they're adults?
Yes, they have. Several people have. They, whilst he was alive, Morris Gross went and visited them. It was Janet didn't want to be interviewed, but the other girl, Margaret, did. Guy Playfair did a BBC program with Janet a few years ago. She's done various interviews with a few people. Margaret has seemingly dropped out a little bit. Janet is increasingly coming through again, I think, not with paranormal stuff, but just reiterating what happened to her when she was a child. Of the two boys, unfortunately, one of them died when he was quite young still. I think he was 18 when he died. And the other one has dropped out of the scene. We don't know what's going on with him.
Janet was, they said, detected in some kind of trickery. Was she pretty good at that?
She was certainly detected in trickery. If everything that she was doing was uncovered, she wasn't that good at it. If, however, she got away with lots and lots of things that were never uncovered, then she was extremely good at it.
And when Gross investigated, what were his conclusions?
His conclusions were very much that the phenomena was genuine. I mean, he used to use a percentage, which I hated, which was 98% of it is genuine, 2% of it is trickery. And I used to say to him, because we were quite friendly, I used to say to him, well, if you're going to say that, I'm going to say it's the other way around, and, which I think is equally daft. But there we go. One keeps away from the percentage game when talking about this. But he was convinced. And even more so, I think, because a year before the investigation, which he was sent to do, his own daughter had been tragically killed in a motorbike accident.
Oh, gosh.
Her name was Janet.
How bizarre. Now, skeptic Joe Nickel examined this case. He was not a believer. Of course, Joe, who's been on our program before, he doesn't believe much anyway.
No, I've read lots of his things. And I think, yep, fair enough. You've got your viewpoint. He's an intelligent man. He comes across well. But I think that he's a little bit too close-minded about things. I think he should open up a little bit, not so much that his brains fall out.
Let's go to Darcy in Milton, Washington, first-time caller. Hi, Darcy. Go ahead.
Hi.
Good to have you with us. Yeah?
I wanted to ask the doctor about the music. I had an experience.
Sure. What happened?
Well, it was quite a number of years ago, and I'm up in my 80s right now, so I'm trying to pull all this back since I heard this. There was a group of spiritual people that I belong with up at Crystal Mountain, if you've ever heard of that.
I have, yeah.
Resort. We had, there was about 100 of us up there, and one of our guests, for one of the programs, was an Andrea Arrowsmith. Has the doctor ever heard of her?
No, I'm afraid I haven't. I'm writing her name down now in case I look her up in the future.
Yeah, tell us about her, Darcy.
Well, she was partially or nearly fully blind, deaf, and so she read lips, but she heard the music, and she played the most exquisite music, and I was looking to see if I had some of her tapes still here. Some of them have gotten taken. But one of them was called The Clarion Call. I think that was the first one that she did, spiritual music. And after our program, when all the girls had left, there was only the two people left. And the one lady had not received her spiritual note. So Andrea said that she would stay there, and they were over in the corner by the door out to the deck, and I was sitting over by the fireplace and just listening to them. The lady happened to be my roommate there, so that's why I was there. And Andrea was playing this music, and all of a sudden we heard a choir of angels. They were right there in the room. And we all three of us, and it was just magnificent. I mean, it was something that I'll never forget.
And what was her name again, the artist?
Her name is Andrea Arrowsmith.
Okay, and I'll have you look that up, Melvin, one day. A choir of angels. That would be something, huh? Those angelic voices are always kind of cool.
Yes, I have. I've pumped that into my machine as you were talking, and I have Andrea Arrowsmith in front of me, Celestial Sounds and Soul Sounds. She did an interview, which I've found online fairly quickly and easily, about the music of the spheres and about angelic voices, etc. So, I mean, yes, there seems to be quite a lot about her, which I must admit I hadn't heard of.
Now, you've written a book about music and the paranormal. Have you published a CD based on the paranormal music?
I produced a CD for my first PhD. In fact, I did one for the second one, I've just remembered, which was part of the university examination board. They wanted examples of what was going on. But I haven't commercially produced it at all, no. But, I mean, if anybody got hold of my theses, which are available at universities and the British Library and that sort of stuff, then there should be a CD or possibly a cassette from the old days that's attached to them that gives examples of the actual music.
As we go west of the Rockies, Huntington Beach, California, we go to Brandon. Welcome to the program, Brandon. Good to have you with us.
Good morning, George, and good morning, Dr. Melvin. Appreciate your time. 20-year listener, first time ever.
Well, great. Thank you. What got you to call?
I've tried to call before, just never made it through.
Ah, so okay.
I got lucky tonight. I got a quick two-part question, and the first one is addressed to you and Dr. Melvin. I've been infatuated since I was a kid with the 1800s, and my question is, there's things that typically wouldn't make sense. I learned how to train wild Mustangs on my own. I've been a gold prospector for years, long before it was a big thing on TV. Taught myself, but my whole house is furnished with the 1800s. And so my question is, do you think that's possibly a reincarnate thing? Because if I don't have that kind of stuff surrounding me and that lifestyle, I don't feel complete. Or do you think it's maybe just a transcendent from, you know, passed down from family, although my dad was born in Holland? And my second part is, real quick, and this might be more focused towards you, George, is the lights on the moon. What are your thoughts on that? I've seen them personally with my telescope, and do you think it's...
They could be very, very unusual. I'll just say that. They could be reflections, of course, but they could also be objects on the moon that are emitting these lights, to be sure. And in terms of his first question, you want to take a stab at that, Melvin?
Yeah, sure. Yes. As far as reincarnation is concerned, yes, there's a lot of evidence. A gentleman called Ian Stevenson did extensive studies on reincarnation from around the world, and he came to the conclusion that it's a genuine phenomena. If you wanted to pursue your own particular case further, if you was to find a legitimate regression therapist, this is somebody that relaxes you via hypnotism and then just asks you to go back further into your life, into your previous life, sorry, I should say, then you may find that there's something there that can be really checked up on, specific facts, rather than these sensations that you have, which are perfectly genuine, which may lead to reincarnation. They may not lead anywhere. And as far as the moon is concerned, I that's not my realm, so I leave that one to George, as you heard.
Okay, let's take Barry in Rock Hill, South Carolina. How you feeling, Barry?
As a matter of fact, George, I feel darn good.
Good.
But they're telling me things might not be so good.
What do you mean? What are they saying?
Looks like I went in the hospital with a mild stroke, George, and I've recovered from that semi, but it looks like I may have caught the virus while I was in there.
Oh, no. Well, fight it.
I'm going to, George. I mean, as a matter of fact, they're coming to my house today to give me the definitive result. I mean, they would do a blood test.
Well, you let us know.
I sure will. Of course I will, George. But I tell you the honest truth, George, I'm 77. I'm mostly blind. I don't have any teeth. And I tell you the truth, and I know this sounds crazy, but I'm just about ready to go, George.
Well, don't leave unless you decide to call the program from the other side.
Boy, oh boy, that's a great idea. But listen, for your guest tonight, the doctor, I'm fascinated by the fact that he knows Lionel Fanthorn.
Yep, Lionel's a great guy. And we always have a 'Twas the Night Before Christmas event that he recorded for us, Melvin, that we play with his great little voice. And I shouldn't say little, it's pretty deep.
He's a big man.
That's right. He's a good guy. He really is.
Yeah.
Thanks, Barry. Barry is one of our favorite listeners, a great caller, and he had a stroke several weeks ago, and he's out of the hospital now. But like he said, it looks like he might have COVID now, so he's got to fight that too.
Yeah, well, good luck to him. Good luck.
Jersey Doug in New Jersey. Hey, Jersey, welcome to the show.
Good evening, gentlemen. How are you tonight?
Okay, very good.
I'm glad to hear that. Yes, I'm very grateful I got through tonight. My luck is usually pretty good, but when you have somebody on of this caliber when it comes to the paranormal and whatnot, I always try to get through. I have one question, and so far my batting average hasn't been good getting through. But perhaps your guest could answer this.
Okay, give it a try.
Ever since I was I'm in my late 50s now. Ever since I was a youngster, I had seen a spectral picture of a ghost coming down a stairway of a church in England. And it was supposedly one of the first ghosts ever captured on film. It was a tin plate, so, you know, there was no trickery or nothing like that any there. I've always been amazed by that, and as I got older and, you know, got more into this and, you know, what you're talking about various things that happened, I always wondered on these shows, which is probably about a 10 or a baker's dozen on TV now about the paranormal. There's maybe about four of them worth watching, but the ones that I do notice, they come out and they're parapsychologists. These are people who are studying this and they're trying to reach answers. They go to a place, a location, like they had the Penn State Penitentiary. They also had a sanitarium there. And not only them, but other groups had gone into it, and they all came out with the same conclusion. This place is haunted. There is no doubt about it. We've seen spectral visions. We've seen shadow people. We've seen objects move, poltergeist activity, voices, you know, disembodied voices and whatnot. And what gets me is why, if they're studying this and they found a place that they all agree is definitely haunted, why wouldn't they continue to stay there and study that activity instead of just jumping in their vans and
moving on? Yeah, why don't they stay at these things, Melvin?
That's a very good question. I think there's various answers to your question. One is a horrible one, and that's money, because these investigations take a lot of money. The researchers have got to be paid, the people doing the production, the camera people, audio, the whole work, they've all got to be paid, and therefore sometimes the money is just not up for it. Another reason, I think, is that a lot of investigation work is incredibly boring. If you spend a night in a haunted place, I've done this on many occasions, so you've got about, let's say, 10 hours in a haunted place, and 99.9% of it, you're sat there in the cold and the dark thinking, what am I doing?
Yeah, they want out of there and out of there fast. Melvin, we're out of time. But do keep in touch. When the other book is ready, I'd love to have you back on the program. Dr. Melvin Willen. And, of course, you know, we've been going through a lot over the past year. Here's something that I hope is a little uplifting for you.
I believe for every drop of rain falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night, a candle glows. I believe for everyone who goes astray, someone will come to show the way. I believe above the storm's smallest prayer can still be heard. I believe someone in the gray somewhere hears every word. Every time I hear newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see the sky, then I know why. I believe, every time I hear newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see.
That was Elvis Presley belting that one out. We'll get through this, folks. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, Tim Banal, George Knapp, and Ian Punnett, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.